All right, so listen to this. We've got a case today
Okay.
where this guy, he tries to get out of buying a country club for a lot of money, $3 million, by claiming he wasn't mentally all there.
Oh, wow.
This is Fingerhut v. Crowlin Enterprises,
Okay.
and it dives into contract law and how much you can use mental illness to void a contract.
It's a big question. Like, can you just back out of something huge just because you're saying, oh, I wasn't mentally well?
Right.
This case really set the standard, and what happened might surprise you.
So our main guy here is Stanley Fingerhut. This guy, he makes big deals all the time. It's 1968. He's making over 50 grand a year as an investment advisor, runs his own firm. Like, that's some serious cash, especially back then.
Yeah, especially back then. And that's what makes it so interesting,
All
right?
right.
He's a successful businessman. He's not just some guy who doesn't know what he's doing.
Not at all.
You know, he's growing this business, leading it to success, millions in capital.
So Fingerhut decides to buy the Bel Air Country Club. Big decision. $3,075,000.
Wow.
Lawyers, agreements, everything's official. Weeks later, he says, "Wait a minute. I was in the manic phase of manic depressive psychosis when I signed this thing."
Oh, wow. And then that's where Crowlin Enterprises, the seller, comes in.
Right.
And they're like, no way, this guy was totally normal during this whole thing. They had evidence, negotiations, they had legal counsel. He even got like consent from his business partners.
So it sounds like we've got two sides to this story. We could
Totally.
say maybe Fingerhut got cold feet
Right.
and he's just using this as an excuse to back out.
Yeah.
Or maybe he really was having a serious episode that messed with his judgment.
And that's what the court had to figure out.
Right.
Like, was he really not competent mentally when he signed?
Yeah.
And if so, did what he do later, like, change anything,
Okay.
you know?
So what does the law actually say about mental incompetence in a case like this?
Well, the court used what's called the cognitive test. Basically, you know, did the person understand what they were signing and the consequences? It's not just, oh, I have a diagnosis.
Right.
Your mental state actually has to, like, really affect your ability to understand the deal.
So did Fingerhut really understand what he was getting into with this country club purchase?
That's the thing. The court really looked at how he acted during this whole process.
Oh.
Everything. Like, he hired a really fancy law firm, you know,
Yeah.
carefully looked over the terms, had a plan for financing. It's not really screaming psychotic break, right?
So they weren't buying that he was completely out of it, that he didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, and there's also this thing, ratification.
Oh, right.
Even if he was out of it at first, what he did after like changing the closing date, you know, continuing to negotiate,
Right.
could have actually made the contract even stronger.
Wait.
Yeah.
Ratification. What does that even mean?
So say you do something when you're not mentally there, but then later you're back to yourself.
And you just keep acting like it never happened.
Okay.
That's basically ratification. It's like saying, yeah, I'm good with this.
So even if he was manic when he signed, his later actions maybe made it all okay, legally speaking.
Yeah, that's basically it. And this is where Fingerhut gets important for, lawyers and law students.
Sure.
This whole ratification thing, it shows how important it is and how it can change if a contract is valid or not.
So if a lawyer is trying to help their client get out of a contract, they need to watch out for this ratification thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely.
Okay, back to the courtroom.
Okay.
We've got Fingerhut's psychiatrist saying psychosis, but Crowlin has their own expert who says it was just neurosis, not as serious.
And the court said that Crowlin's expert made more sense because of how Fingerhut was acting. If he was, like, totally out of control, it might have been different.
So it's not just what someone says, it's how they acted.
Exactly. Fingerhut shows us in these mental incompetence cases, actions can say more than words. Interesting. So it's not enough to just say, oh, I had anxiety, and expect the court to just toss out the contract.
No, definitely not.
Fingerhut really showed that courts can be skeptical when it comes to these mental health claims in contract cases.
Yeah, for sure.
They want to see actual proof that the mental state directly messed with your ability to understand the deal.
Yeah, they're not going to just take your word for it. You need to show them.
It sounds like Fingerhut v. Crowlin really set the bar high for anyone trying to use mental incompetence as a reason to break a contract.
It really did. And the court even said things like it has to be something as serious as psychosis and that, you know, his ability to think rationally wasn't messed with.
Wow. Strong words. What does all this mean for lawyers and law students who are listening?
It means proving mental incompetence is hard. If that's what your client is trying to do, you better have a really good case, more than just a diagnosis.
And on the flip side, if you're trying to enforce the contract, Fingerhut is on your side. Okay, this has been a great look at Fingerhut. We've got the facts, the legal stuff, and we're starting to see how it affects contract law.
It really has been interesting. And we're just getting started.
You're right. We've only just started. There's still so much to discuss.
Well, I think it definitely made lawyers a lot more careful. You know, if a client's saying, hey, I want to get out of this contract because I wasn't mentally okay, the lawyer has to have a really, really strong case. It's not just about having a diagnosis anymore. You have to show that, like, the mental health issue actually stopped them from understanding the contract.
So you can't just say, oh, my client was depressed or they were anxious. That's not enough.
No, not at all. You have to like connect those dots, show how the condition made them unable to really grasp the contract.
I see. So it's not just about presenting a diagnosis. It's about showing the direct link between the diagnosis and the contract.
Mm-hmm.
But what about when lawyers are writing contracts? Does Fingerhut make them more aware of these mental health issues?
I think so, definitely. Fingerhut is always there in the back of their minds, reminding them, like, hey, you got to make sure your client really understands what they're signing.
Right.
It's not just about explaining all the legal terms. It's about making sure the client is really capable of making this decision.
It's kind of like when a doctor explains the risks of a surgery, right?
Exactly. They want to make sure the patient really understands what they're agreeing to.
Okay, so lawyers have to be more careful now because of Fingerhut. But this case also brings up some much bigger questions, you know, about mental health and legal responsibility. It goes way beyond just contracts.
Yeah, you're right. It kind of started this whole debate about, like, how do we protect people with mental health conditions, but also make sure that people stick to the agreements they make?
It's tough, right? We don't want people just saying, oh, I was stressed to get out of the deal.
Yeah.
But we also don't want to punish someone who genuinely didn't get what they were signing because of a mental health issue.
That's the hard part. And Fingerhut, the way it focuses on actions and a high standard of proof, it seems to be saying that the contract itself is more important.
More important than maybe the person who might be struggling.
Yeah, potentially. Which brings us back to that psychosis standard. Does it still make sense today, you know, in 2025? We know so much more about mental health now. Should it really have to be as serious as psychosis to void a contract?
Like, what if it's depression or anxiety?
Mm-hmm.
If you can prove that it really affected their judgment, should that be enough?
These are questions that courts are dealing with all the time, even today. Fingerhut set a precedent, but the world of law and how we understand mental health, it's always changing.
And it's not just the law, right? Yeah. How we think about mental health in society, it's totally different now than it was in 1971.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's less stigma now, more awareness. We recognize so many more conditions.
So we have to look at Fingerhut with fresh eyes, right? Maybe it's time to rethink that psychosis standard and come up with something new that fits better with how we see mental health in the 21st century.
Right. Like, how do we update things to be fairer to people with mental health conditions without just throwing out the whole idea of contracts?
What would that even look like? How could we change the legal system to be more fair without totally messing up contract law?
Well, one idea is to stop focusing so much on specific diagnoses and look more at how the mental health condition actually affected the person's ability to function, you know, in that particular situation.
So instead of just looking at the label, we look at whether they could actually participate in the contract, no matter what their diagnosis is.
Exactly. Look at their thinking abilities, their emotions. Could they understand the information? Were they easily influenced? A much more personal assessment.
That seems to make more sense, right?
Right.
Because mental health isn't black and white. There's a whole spectrum. And how it affects someone's ability to understand a contract can be really different from person to person.
Totally. We need a system that gets that, you know, what one that protects both people with mental health conditions and the basic ideas of contract law.
That's a tough balance. But it's a conversation that we need to have. And Fingerhut, even though it's from 1971, it's still part of that conversation.
Definitely. It shows us that the law has to keep up with what we know about the world, and that includes how we understand mental health.
I like that the law needs to keep up.
Yeah.
We've really explored Fingerhut in detail. We've got the background, the legal arguments, how it affects lawyers today, and even the ethical side of things.
We've gone deep into the cognitive test, this idea of ratification, and how society's views on mental health have changed so much. But there's one more thing we need to look at. What are the practical things lawyers and law students can take away from this case? How can they actually use what we've learned from Fingerhut in their work? We'll talk about that in the last part of our deep dive.
All right, so we've spent a lot of time talking about Fingerhut v. Crowlin, from what happened in court to the big questions it brings up about mental health and the law. But let's bring it all back down to earth for the people listening, the lawyers and law students working with these kinds of issues every day. What are the big takeaways from Fingerhut? What can they actually use in their practice?
Well, one of the biggest things, and we've talked about it a lot, is documentation. It's super important. If you're a lawyer and you even think there might be an issue with your client's mental capacity, write everything down, how they act, their answers to your questions, if they seem to understand complicated things, just document everything.
So it's like preparing for the worst case scenario, you know, just in case someone challenges the contract later and you have to prove your client was competent.
Exactly. Having good documentation protects you, and it could even win or lose the case for you if mental competence becomes a problem. And for lawyers on the other side, the ones representing the person claiming they were incompetent, Fingerhut shows that a diagnosis isn't enough.
Yeah, you need to show the connection between the mental health condition and the contract.
Right. You need evidence that shows how the condition actually affected their ability to understand the terms, negotiate fairly, or know what the consequences would be. Expert testimony is good, but it has to be supported by facts.
Got it. Documentation and proving the link between the condition and the contract. What else? You mentioned something called ratification before. Can you remind us what that is and why it matters so much?
Ratification is a really important concept in these cases. It basically means that even if someone wasn't competent when they signed a contract, if they later act like it's valid, they might not be able to challenge it anymore.
So let's say they were pressured or tricked into signing it first. If they later make payments, go to meetings, or do anything else that shows they agree with the contract, could that be seen as ratification?
Exactly. It's like they're saying, okay, I'm fine with this now. Their actions basically cancel out any claim that they weren't competent in the first place.
That's huge for lawyers on both sides. If you're trying to help a client get out of a contract, you need to tell them that continuing to act like it's valid could hurt their case.
Absolutely. And if you're trying to uphold a contract, you'll want to highlight any actions that suggest ratification, even if there were questions about the person's mental state when they signed. Fingerhut gives us a good way to understand this really tricky issue.
Okay, documentation, ratification. Any other words of wisdom from Fingerhut?
I think the most important takeaway from Fingerhut is that it really highlights how the law doesn't always keep up with what we know about mental health.
You're right. We've learned so much since 1971 about how to recognize and treat mental illness, but the legal system can be slow to change.
And that's why it's so crucial for lawyers to not just know the case law, but to also stay current on the science and how people think about mental health. They can't get stuck in the past. Stay updated on new research, how diagnoses are made, and how attitudes are changing.
So being a good lawyer isn't just about knowing the law. It's also about being an advocate for better understanding of mental health and making sure the legal system keeps up with what's real.
Exactly. We have a duty to fight for our clients, but also to make sure the legal system is fair and works well. And sometimes that means pushing back against outdated standards, like the psychosis standard in Fingerhut, and arguing for a more modern, more nuanced approach.
You know, that reminds me of something we discussed earlier, moving away from strict diagnoses and instead focusing on how the mental health condition actually affected the person's ability to understand and participate in the contract.
Yes. It's about looking at the whole person and situation. Was this person truly able to understand what they were agreeing to and what would happen because of it? It's more complicated, but it could be much fairer.
It just shows that mental health isn't a simple yes or no question. There's so much variation, and the law needs to catch up and recognize that.
Totally agree. It's a constant challenge. And even though Fingerhut v. Crowlin is a case from over 50 years ago, it's still making us think and talk about how we deal with mental health in contract law.
Well, I think we've really covered Fingerhut v. Crowlin Enterprises from every angle. We've looked at the legal details, the ethical dilemmas, the practical takeaways, and how it all fits into the bigger picture of mental health and the law.
It's been a really interesting journey, and I hope our listeners understand this landmark case better now and see how it's still shaping the legal world today.
Me too. And maybe this deep dive will even inspire some future legal minds to challenge the way things are and fight for a more fair and just way to handle mental health in contract law.
That would be amazing. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive. It's been great exploring this complex and thought-provoking case with you.
It was my pleasure. Until next time, everyone, keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep pushing the boundaries of legal thinking.